Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. Romance novels rake in over $1 billion every year. While it's hard to say how many romance novels include Native stories and characters, there aren't too many that tell realistic stories because there aren't too many Native romance novelists. We invited a few Native romance authors to join us today and talk about combating stereotypes in Native love and lust. Join us right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders in Montana are pulling out of the Attorney General's Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous People after he announced his intent to support the Keystone XL pipeline in court. Olivia Reingold has more.
The Attorney General of Montana, Republican Tim Fox, appointed members to the task force this spring. Now, some are resigning because Fox, who's running for governor, wants to join a lawsuit in support of the Keystone XL pipeline.
He's shaking your hand with one hand, but on the back, he's crossing his fingers and telling the state to go forward with this pipeline.
Assiniboine and Sioux tribal member Justin Dupree is one of two who've resigned since Monday. The task force has 11 members, including 8 tribal representatives. The only tribal member who could be reached in time for broadcast says she's considering leaving the task force and is talking it over with her tribe. Dupree says man camps that house temporary pipeline workers would increase violence and missing persons cases. That's something he worries about for his two daughters. Pipeline projects and crime rates are connected, according to the recent Canadian inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. The pipeline would cross the Missouri River a quarter mile upstream from the Fort Peck Nation. Dupree says the pipeline would economically develop some parts of the state, but
the reservation is going to see a majority of the bad things that follow that.
Fox says the pipeline would be an economic boon for the state, primarily filling the 7 counties it's supposed to cross with $63 million in property taxes. He's filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit to support the pipeline Monday.
But I guess, what do you have to say to the tribes of Montana, specifically Fort Belknap, who say, hey, this wouldn't benefit us, we don't want this?
Well, I think that I haven't looked at that statement. I don't know that that's a correct statement, because the tax revenues from the pipeline being built alone will be a benefit to all Montanans.
Former task force member Dupree says the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes won't be able to collect on the pipeline's property taxes because it won't cross into Roosevelt County, where the reservation is located. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
A special ceremony was held recently in Canada to remember the Indigenous children who died in the residential school system. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a banner held the names of nearly 3,000 students who died.
The cloth banner was blood red, and the names of 2,800 children were emblazoned on it in stark white. The banner was unveiled at the Canadian Museum of History. It comes after years of research into what happened to Indigenous children who were taken from their homes and placed in the schools and never seen again. From the late 1800s to the mid-1900s, about 150,000 Canadian Indigenous children were forced to attend the church-run, government-funded schools. Thousands were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Many also died. Dr. Barney Williams is an elder and survivor of the residential school system.
There's a lot missing still, but people are remembering that so-and-so didn't come home because they never came. They just were wherever they were, wherever they were buried, wherever they were left. We didn't know that. Like, I'm 80 years old now, and it's finally to see something like this for me is really heartwarming and also, like I said, very emotional, because I often, in my journey, often wondered what happened.
It's believed another 1,600 children may have died. The present list comes after the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission called for the government to create a register of those who lost their lives because of the residential schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now, National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska, and online at sanofsky.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Romance novels usually have a central love story and a positive ending. You can spot one by the book cover, which includes a couple embracing with or without a shirtless man. You know the ones. Romance novels bring in over $1 billion annually. And there are a bunch of different kinds of romance novels, including contemporary romance, paranormal romance, and historical romance. And historical romance is where we're most likely to see Native American characters. While it's a huge market and genre, Romance Writers of America, the Association of Romance Writers of America, agrees that there could be more diversity in writers. That was in response to a National Public Radio piece last year about the diversity in the genre. In this hour, we'll talk with a few Native romance authors about Native representation in the genre and what it takes to write this kind of love story. And you can join us, too. Are you a fan of romance novels? We know romance novels have different levels of sensuality. What do you think about telling Native stories that include sex? Do we need more or less of this kind of fictional storytelling? Give us a call. Join the conversation. You can call in anonymously if you like. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Fort Frances, Ontario in Canada is Maggie Blackbird. She writes romance starring Canada's Indigenous people, and she is Ojibwe from Northwest Ontario. Welcome to Native America Calling, Maggie.
Hi.
Okay, so I imagine that you read romance before you started writing it. Tell us about some of the first romance novels that you've read.
This would be a stretching of a bit back, but I used to read a lot of Johanna Lindsay, a lot of Roseanne Bittner, those types of historical romance authors.
And what impression did you get from them when you first started reading romance novels?
I enjoyed it. I liked the development of the relationship within the novel, the different conflicts the hero or the heroine had with each other, and how they would resolve it. I'm a people person, so I like seeing how people tick, and romance gives you a really good look into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, tell us about your journey from reading romance novels to being a romance novelist yourself.
Oh, God. You know, I've always written, and like I said, I was drawn to the romance genre probably when I was about 12 years old, I'd say. And I would just write short stories just for myself to entertain myself. I've always been that way, using my imagination. And when I was about, I'd say maybe 23, 24, I started writing and just kept on writing, whether they were science fiction, romances, or anything like that, whatever came off the top of my head. And then it wasn't until maybe around 2010 when I decided, well, I'm going to start writing about my own people. And I want to write in contemporary times and let people know what we're really like, that, you know, we fall in love and we get married and we have children and everything like that. So that's how it all started.
And how did you end up getting published?
I wrote the book. I had to make sure you do a lot of networking first with other authors in the genre. And I met an author in Nova Scotia we belong to a website. It's for supporting romance authors, and it's called Romance Divas. And that's where I met her, and she told me about where she had published her book. And I thought, okay, great, that's in Canada, because I was looking for a Canadian publisher for the tax purposes, because I wasn't sure how that works in the States. So I thought it'd be easier just to work with a publisher in Canada. And she told me about her publisher, Ecstasy Books. So I said, okay, well, you know, I have my manuscript. I have everything all set and ready to go. So I emailed the publisher, and I was expecting to wait the standard. It's usually 4, 8 to 12 weeks. But I was really surprised when the owner herself emailed me back the next day and said she'd read the manuscript and she wanted it. So it just took off from there.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting to hear that, you know. You hear so many stories of authors who say that they can sort of wallpaper their wall with rejections and things like that. Was it that your editor was really looking for a native author? Do you think that played into it?
What's that?
Do you think that it played into it, the fact that she read it so quickly and responded so quickly, that the fact that you're native had anything to do with it?
I think she just liked the writing. When she emailed me back, she said, this is good writing. I like it. I'm going to send it to our acquisitions department. And that was it. She didn't mention anything about native or anything like that. So
that's great. What was the title of the book?
Blessed. It was my first published book in the Mottawapit family series.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about this series.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wanted to touch on, we're up in Canada. I wanted a more isolated community. A lot of them are fly-in. You can't get there, you know, by train or plane or anything like that. And my brother actually used to work up in those areas as a fire prevention training officer, and I always wanted to write about that area. I had cousins who lived up there, too. So, and I took a look into that. I was listening to the newscast earlier about the Indian residential schools in Canada. My father and his brothers and sisters and everybody all attended them, so he was a great resource for that. And I wanted to combine it also with a lot of them also have Christian churches throughout those reserves. And I thought, you know, what it would be like if you had those who are traditional and those who are Christian, and that they're all intermixing that way. So that's where it came from. The series was born from. So the first one is about the deacons. The deacon is Ojibwe, full-blooded, and it's about his youngest son, Emery, and Emery's former lover, Daryl. This one's a gay romance. He's two-spirit, and it just kind of took off from there, where Emery's discerning the priesthood, and Daryl feels otherwise about it, and he has quite a bone to pick with the religion. He lost a lot. He's an intergenerational survivor, and that means he had parents and aunts and uncles who had gone to the school, and how it impacted Daryl in his present-day life. So
we are talking with Maggie Blackbird. She writes romance novels that are focused around Canada's Indigenous people. And that's our conversation today. Romance novels. What do you think? Give us a call and share. If you read romance novels, what was the last one that you read? Call us and tell us about it. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Maggie, I imagine that you put a lot of thought into approaching these really, you know, difficult topics like boarding schools, residential schools in Canada, into your books. Talk to us about that and your sort of process for deciding what to put in and what to share.
It basically, when you're doing all your research and everything, it's only to make the story real. What you're really focused on when you're writing is the actual plot of the book itself, and how you combine the research into it. Like I said, I wanted to touch on when I came up with the story, I really wasn't trying to be controversial or anything. And then when people were reading it, they would mention, this is a controversial subject. And I would think, oh, okay, well, all I wanted to write about was the conflict between the two main heroes, because conflict is what drives a romance novel and how they're going to resolve it. So Emery, he's at the beginning of the novel, he's a Catholic seminarian, and he's trying to figure out what his true calling is, and is it the priesthood, or is it his ex-lover, who is Daryl, and who has a big chip on his shoulder. And combining the residential school was only natural to happen, because it impacts so many communities and people, even to this day, that's happening in their lives, whether it's, when they try to survive through it, like my dad's own story, where he came out of the school very angry, very bitter, very upset. The drinking or anything that they try to do to not numb the pain. So Daryl's aunt, who his family dies when he's 4 years old, and his aunt was also raised in the residential school, and she has a big chip on her shoulder. So a lot of that impacts Daryl, where he picks up on that as a young boy of 4 years old, and it's what he grows up and sees is what the residential school has done to his aunt and how it has made her very angry and very upset. So he automatically, blames the deacon, who has decided to embrace the religion that the deacon was taught in the residential school, where Daryl feels it's a slap in the face to their own people. And
Oh, that's so interesting. I can't wait to take a look at it and read it. We are talking about romance novels today, and Maggie Blackbird is with us. She's Ojibwe from Northwest Ontario. If you like romance novels, if you've picked one up and you really like what you're reading, give us a call and share, 1-800-996-2848. Also, we're going to get into some of the stereotypes that show up in romance novels when they write about Native characters. We'll be right back. The Klamath River has the same rights as people, according to a new law passed by the Yurok Tribal Council. In New Zealand, members of a Maori tribe fought to have a river given personhood status. It's part of a growing movement to protect the environment. We'll learn more about it on the next Native America Calling.
The National Indian Education Association is celebrating 50 years of building education nations, strengthening and advancing Native control of Native education at the Minneapolis Convention Center, October 8th through the 12th. We'll explore critical topics that advance educational opportunities for Native students. We'll connect with friends and colleagues with an awards gala, a cultural heritage night, and a powwow. Online registration ends September 13th at niea.org. Proud to support this show.
Jao yan ri kan ka ka kok atori ka ayayo ri yan ayayo ri yan nunane ri lukika yugal ri ka e ka ka kok jao yan ri kan ka ka kok jao yan ri kan
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. We're talking about romance novels today. It's a big industry, and there are just a few Native writers who are making some of our romantic fantasies come true. If you're a fan of romance novels, give us a call. What about them do you like? The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we've been talking with Maggie Blackbird. She is a romance novelist based in Canada. Maggie, anything else you want to share about your series, starting with the first one, Blessed? How does the series develop through time?
Oh, basically, the main series arc is the two families that are in conflict, and one, of course, is the Mattawapit family, where the deacon, he has raised his children Catholic, and it is also the Kabate family. The last two books and also Blast touch on the Kabate family, who are traditional and are against having religion, a lot of Western culture, everything brought into the preserve. And what they're trying to do is preserve the culture, so they clash. So the arc kind of goes all the way through with my most previous novel, where the deacon's eldest son, Jude, he falls in love with the Kabate's youngest daughter. And like I said, they're both on opposing sides. And what this, what the whole, I guess you would call it, theme through it is reconciliation and respecting one another's different beliefs. And trying to reconcile them. That's basically the whole overall arc for the series. And each one has to do that, each book.
It sounds like a challenging topic, but also really interesting to be able to sort of weave all of these stories together with these two different families. We're talking romance novels today. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to Candida in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there. Thanks for calling in today. What are you thinking about when it comes to romance novels?
Hello, Monica and Maggie. This is Candida Jones, and I'm calling because I spent 7 summers in Algonquin Park in Northern Ontario, which is imbued with Ojibwe traditions and philosophies. And I just finished reading a book written about a Western band in Grassy Narrows in Western Ontario. I don't know if that's where you're from, but it was a book called A Poison Stronger Than Love, and it was just an incredible book that obviously deals with love, but in a non-fictional fashion, and about what happened to the population being moved and having their traditional ways basically bludgeoned, both by mercury poisoning and just relocation. And I just wanted to tribute you for writing about these very important subjects. The stories that we read definitely affect our understanding and help us solve problems.
Was it considered a romance novel, Candida?
No, but the title, as I explained to the gentleman I spoke to, it's A Poison Stronger Than Love is the name of the book. And so it seemed germane since it dealt with the Ojibwe of Western Ontario, where Maggie is from.
All right. Thank you so much for giving us a call. And Maggie, you know, that's an interesting thought about, you talk about residential schools and things like that in your work, really dealing with these difficult topics like Grassy Narrows. You know, they've had a boil water advisory for, what is it, like 20 or 30 years. How do you manage to sort of weave those things into your stories and still make them something that people want to keep reading and want to keep turning the page?
You know, that's a really good question, because I do write about those topics. And actually, in the one book Redeemed, the heroine Bridget does mention it. All the reserves I have in there are fictional, of course, but she talks about how one had mercury dumped into the river and what's happening to it. And, of course, the reserve is fictional, but what I'm using is Grassy Narrows as an example of how she wants people to be educated about what's happening with the Indigenous people of Canada. And so it's just a matter of, you know, when you look at it, it's your kind of everyday life that you live with. And life still happens. You know, people still get up. They still go to bed. They still fall in love. They still get married. They still have children. So that's how I weave it in. It's just a part of their everyday life and what they experience. And it all becomes a part of the story. Mm-hmm. For that one, it was the residential schools for this series. For another one that I'm looking at down the road, it would be the 60s scoop and how it impacts the heroes and heroines that's going to be in that series. So it's just building it in as part of who they are and what their life is about.
That's great. Let's add some more voices to our conversation about romance novels. And if you want to get in on this conversation, phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Joining us from Taos, New Mexico is Malia Powell. She is a professor in the College of Arts and Letters at Michigan State University, an avid romance reader and writer, and faculty in American Indian Studies. And she has Indiana Miami ancestry. Welcome to Native America Calling, Malia.
Thank you.
Also, we've got Karen Kay joining us from Connecticut. She is a historical romance author, and she is Choctaw and adopted Blackfeet. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Karen.
Oh, thank you. Hi.
Hello. Malia, let's start with you. Okay, so we talked with Maggie a little bit about just, you know, every romance writer starts with a passion for reading romance. What hooked you to romance novels, and when did you start reading them?
I started reading romance novels when I was somewhere between 11 or 12. My mother belonged to this group of women, this sort of reading circle where they would trade paper bags full of romance novels, westerns, detective fiction around with each other. Like every couple weeks, a new bag of books would come to our house. And so I started reading them, and I liked the romance novels better because there were women in them. you know, the westerns and detective fiction didn't really have a lot of women in them in any kind of roles that seemed to have any power or agency. And so I've been reading them for a really long time, and I think when I was in my 20s, started looking for romance novels that might have Native people in them, and as you mentioned, really found only historical novels, the same ones that Maggie talked about, Joanna Lindsay, Roseanne Bittner, and so I've been reading for a really long time.
What about you, Karen? Did you start when you were in your teens?
Yes, probably around the same time that you mentioned. I was 11 or 12, and I got my romance books from the library. Really loved them. And then when I kind of gave it up. And then when I was in high school, I rediscovered them in another series, also from the library. And then I really became a fan of the romance genre after I had my children. And my husband was gone a lot during that time, and I had two small kids. They were both babies. And it was a tough time for me, and especially at night, you know, and I discovered that if I would read romance novels, it would calm me down enough to go to sleep. And so romance novels really became a friend to me. And that's really when I decided, you know, I wonder if I could write these because I just fell in love with them. They became something that was a part of my life at that time, and they have remained that way to this day.
Malia, when you started reading, you know, romance novels that had Native characters in it, I remember the first one that I read, and it was centered around a non-Native woman who was captured by a tribe as, maybe like a teenager or something like that, and she grew up in the tribe and then fell in love with someone in the tribe. And I remember reading it and thinking, I don't know, is any of this true? Is any of this correct? What kind of thoughts did you have when you first encountered Native characters in romance novels?
I mean, they were very similar. They were almost always either a mixed blood woman who was, you know, in love with a white man, or some sort of, you know, noble savage man who was in love with a white woman. Sometimes they were definitely sort of sometimes captive, or there was another relationship, like, you know, that had to do with really what my scholar self would say, reasserting American colonialism into the genre, right? This kind of like the dying savage trope. And so I didn't like that about them. I found some folks who Kathleen Eagle, Sherry Whitefeather, married to Native men, who seemed to write a little bit differently, but they were writing contemporary. And you know, so throughout grad school, as I'm getting this degree focusing on Native studies, I got more and more dissatisfied with the way that I was seeing Native people represented. And I wasn't seeing anyone like the Native people I knew, right? Not on a reservation, not really in a big urban area, just sort of Native folks in the Midwest, living their lives every day, contributing to their community, lawyers, factory workers, farmers. And so that's one of the things that made me think that maybe I should try to write them, is to represent that sort of the very non-stereotypical, like middle average, everyday kinds of folks who are Native in this country.
Where's the romance in that? Farmers and lawyers, you know?
Well, I mean, there is romance in that. If you look at romance novels that are not Native focused, without Native characters, you know, Laurie Handelin wrote a whole series about this farm family in Wisconsin. And, you know, there are always lawyers and CEOs and, you know, various other folks that are mostly white. There's been some really interesting work, I think, around African-American romance novels in the past 10 years, also with a variety of kinds of occupations. But I think the thing that I like about romance novels now that I'm older is I like having that moment where I can disappear into a story that I don't have to fix, but it's got people in it that I recognize.
Hmm. Oh, I love that. Do you find romance novels something that you can delve into the story and recognize, you know, your own personal experiences or see yourself in? Call us and share, 1-800-996-2848. Karen, you write historical fiction, historical romance. Tell us what about the process that goes into creating these stories and telling them.
Sure. Well, let me just back up just a little. I first got, my first reading of a Native American romance, I was already an adult and I had children. That's how long it took. When I was in high school, the only thing I could find to read that had any Native Americans in them was James Fenimore Cooper, The Last of the Mohicans, The Deerslayer, etc. I read them. But they certainly weren't romance. As far as historical romance, a lot of research goes into your historical romance. You're going to be researching the tribe that you're writing about and also that time period that you're writing about. There are some things that you can research, like, for instance, I really am fascinated by the old ancestral scout. They used to call their scouts wolves, and those people were incredible. Those men had abilities, sensory perceptions that are unusual, And they were taught this, which I thought I found was extremely interesting. And I really love the concept of the old scouts. And particularly, they were taught to be to put their perception out way into the environment, way out into the environment, so that if something came into the environment that wasn't part of it, they were instantly alert to it. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And there is a book. It is not written by a native man, but he was taught the way of the scout by an old Apache scout. And it's called The Way of the Scout by Tom Brown, Jr. And fascinating, fascinating book. As soon as I found out about this clan that each tribe had, the clan of the wolf or the scout, amazing, just amazing. So there's a lot of research that goes into a historical. That's the first thing, is to research the tribe, research the, you might call it the profession. Was he a scout? Was he a chief? All men went out and they hunted. They were all hunters. But some had other duties besides hunter, like warrior, scout, medicine man, chief, etc. And so you research a lot of that. Probably, I think, more research goes into that than anything else, into the tribe, the way they talked, the word usage. I have lots of dictionaries here of Lakota and Blackfeet and, the Assiniboine, but the Assiniboine were also Lakota. And Crow. I have lots of dictionaries here of the language itself. And that's another whole research. Another research that I love is sign language. And, of course, all tribes knew sign language. And when tribes would get together or people that didn't speak the same language, I found out that they didn't just do large amounts of sign language. They would abbreviate it down so that not everyone could follow exactly what they were saying. Fascinating.
Hang on, Karen. We got to go to a short break. I want to talk more about your historical romance novels that you share, that you write and publish. And you are invited to the conversation as well. Give us a call if you like romance novels, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to go to a short break. After the break, we're going to continue with romance novel authors.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Thanks for joining us today on Native America Calling. We are focusing on romance novels written by Native authors. Do you have a favorite romance novelist? Are you a fan of Native romance? Do you think we should be telling more of our love and relationship stories? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-996-2848. Maggie Blackbird is with us. She writes romance novels that involve Canada's Indigenous people. And we've got Malia Powell. She's a professor and an avid romance reader and writer. And Karen Kay. She writes historical romance, and she's Choctaw. And Karen, before the break, you were talking about the amount of research that goes into writing historical romance. I find that a lot of historical romance that involves Native characters are where we find the majority of the stereotypes about Native people. And I was just curious how you approach, you know, your writing, making sure that it doesn't include a lot of stereotypes.
I don't put a lot of attention, to tell you the truth, because you're writing history at the same time. And so you have an incoming culture that's different than the one that you want to really portray in your book. And so the viewpoint is from that particular person who's looking out upon it and seeing similarities and differences at that time, and showing not only good qualities, but things about it that they don't like. Mostly, however, I have to be honest here, I do not like saying bad things about any Native population. I just have a thing about it that from my pen and from my mouth is not going to come criticism. And be that good or bad, I just do not want to have that come from my mouth or my pen. So usually when I'm writing about these, I go into the viewpoint of the person who's looking at it and really look at it from her viewpoint, what she's seeing as opposed to what she's always been taught. And then sometimes, not as much as the heroine, but with a hero, you'll get into his viewpoint, and you'll see the same thing. He'll be looking at differences and similarities and why this is what it is. One of the hardest things that I had to write was a series that I did on the Iroquois. It was a difficult series in many ways, but a wonderful series. In many ways, too. I learned so much from my study of the Iroquois, the government that they had, their mindset, fascinating, and even how they influenced our own country and the people who wrote our documents for this country. The Iroquois were quite influential in that, which I found fascinating. But they were also a little bit difficult to write about because of torture. So I really kind of left it out, to tell you the truth. I couldn't accept, perhaps in one book I put in not much torture, but the heroine was what you might call bothered by what you would call hoodlums. Who also had a reason for being hoodlums, but don't go into it in very, very much detail. That was very hard for me. And I had to do a lot of research from captive stories about that, which was difficult. It's not something that I really liked. But overall, I would say that writing about the Iroquois taught me how much Native America really influenced people, really influenced people. There was a quality about all throughout Native America of freedom. We're free, you know, no chains on us. And that, you know, from people who were yearning to be free
was quite impressive. And if you read stories of that time, even in England, they would comment on the Indian, excuse me for saying that word, but the Indian influence, because that's what they were called at that time, influence over the Americans, that the call of freedom was everywhere in all of the colonists due to this. Wow, that's quite a legacy. And it's not spoken about very much, and sometimes I blog about it because I really think that's very, very, very important, the role that was played in making this country as free as it is and different from any other country, even where they have freedom. Our country is different.
Yeah. That's really interesting, Karen. It's an interesting perspective that I can tell shows up in your novels. Malia, I want to ask you that same question about how writers, when they're writing about Native characters, how they can avoid stereotypes and the common pitfalls that sort of put Native people into one category or another.
I mean, I think that in my writing, I choose to focus on the contemporary, and there's so much going on with Indigenous people in the Americas these days that it's actually easy to look around and see how people are managing their relationship to their communities, to their jobs, to dominant culture, to doing amazing art and music and, Native fashion design. And so it's easy to sort of like take inspiration from what's happening right now and represent that in a way that tries to intervene. I will say that, editors have pushed back at me a little bit because there are still a lot of contemporary series that put Native people into this sort of like uber warrior category. And it's not that I haven't met a lot of folks that I would call warriors. It's just that they don't act like I think dominant culture thinks warriors act like, right? Grandmothers who walk around the Great Lakes with a copper bucket full of water are warriors. And so I think so that's the advantage of contemporary, is there's so much material out there that that you can represent as real life, everyday life. But I also think, it's a little bit harder go when you're trying to push back with editors and with even with readers, right, with beta readers. I've had folks say, this just doesn't seem very Native to me. And I'm like, this is what Native people are like, man. Like, we're watching Netflix and eating ice cream. But I did have an editor say to me, I was doing a pitch at RWA a few years ago, and she's like, I really like your manuscript, but could this lawyer also be a shaman?
It's not enough to just be a lawyer. You got to have one or two more things going on.
I was so nervous about that pitch, and then I just stopped flat, and I said, no, actually, those are both full-time jobs.
But here's my question, Malia. Maybe you've researched this at all, but if I went on historical romance novels solely and based my opinion on them, it would seem to me that like 50% of white people were captured by Native people and kept in captivity for, a duration of their lifetimes based on, just what I've read in romance novels. What do you think about that, Malia?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I have a collection of historical romance novels with Native people in them that I've written about and presented about and that I am continuing to write about. I think, Karen is really brave to write historicals because I think that those are the most solidly embedded stereotypes in the sort of like, in the psyche of both folks in North America generally, the U.S. and Canada. That idea is like one of those sort of ideas that still, fuels things like mascots and arguments about who's Native and who isn't. And so I think that it's one of the, those are some of the hardest stereotypes to break. But yeah, you're right. Apparently everyone is captured and falls in love and has babies and lives a lovely life afterwards. I'm just like, wow.
What are you working on right now, Malia?
I'm working on a book called Marked by Love, and it's about two people who were in the Native Americans at Dartmouth program, and one of them became a college professor who runs an educational center, and the other became a museum director. And they fell in love in college, and then due to the misunderstandings of your 20s, broke up, and this is their second chance at love. I find as I get older, I like those second chance stories a lot more, because we all need a lot of second chances.
That sounds great. What about you, Maggie? What are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm getting ready to put out the fourth book in the Mottawapit family series. I'm actually in the middle of doing my edits right now. And I'm also getting ready to release two short stories as well. I'm also working on those with the publisher. One is going to be a Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving, and the other one a Christmas.
Oh, what's it like to go through the editing process? I imagine it's so challenging to just get everything down on paper, and then you have to go back and do more. Talk to us about that.
You know, I'm one of those rare writers who loves editing. I love the process because there's perfectionism in me where it's why I don't read my books after they're done, because I want to go in and change some more. But it's a good process where basically you get your edits back from your editor. You go through everything and address any questions or comments or anything that they have in it. And then sometimes, you know, you're cutting scenes, and I'm one of those who also doesn't mind to cut scenes or doesn't mind doing some rewrites or anything like that. I'm one of those who just loves being challenged to make it the best book that I can make it. So.
So you don't have you ever had a time when you've really had to push back on an editor and say, no, we've got to keep this. This is important.
You know what? I'm very lucky with my publishing house and my editor. They are really understanding about when I tell them, you know, well, this is what it's like, so it has to stay. Or we work something out where it's also reader friendly. Or where the reader can understand it, because there's a lot of rouse speak and everything in my books and everything. Where we try make it so that they don't get lost. The whole goal is to not confuse the reader and make them have to step back from the book. Our whole job is to keep that reader reading and turning the pages. So once in a while, we got to do a little bit of fine tuning just for that sake. And especially because there's different speaks, too. Like in my Thanksgiving story, you'll find she's from the boundary waters of Canada, and he's from a reservation in Minnesota. So they joke about it. We say band, you say tribe. You know, they're the differences in their language, too. Their everyday speak.
What about you, Karen? What are you working on?
Well, like Maggie, I'm in the middle of edits. I just actually began edits. I just a few days ago was able to type the end of the news story. It's called The Eagle and the Flame. And it's gone into editing now. And so that's my next book, and I hope to have it out sometime in November. But that's going to depend on the editing process. Like Maggie, I like editing. I like it when an editor goes through and she finds, like, words I'm repeating or a scene that she just doesn't understand. I like that. You know, you want to fix those things so that the reader doesn't get stopped. And unlike a lot of other people who write Native American historical romances, I don't actually have the heroine usually captured. Mm. I try to think of different scenarios that could be, you know, in a plot, how they could get together. The only time
I wrote about someone capturing another. It was the female, the heroine, who captured the Native American man. And that's the only story that I ever had any sort of capture scene. And there were a lot of instances in historical, in the real world, where people weren't captured, but they came together anyway. Lots of them. And so I like to focus on that, you know, just to be maybe a little different.
Karen, where can folks find your novels?
Right now, they're on Amazon. They're also at Barnes & Noble. Not all of them. All of my books are at Amazon. Some of them are at Kindle Unlimited. So all of them are at Amazon. But they're also at Barnes & Noble and Kobo, iTunes, that sort of thing.
All right.
But they're online.
We'll put a link to Karen's website on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. And Maggie, I know that we can find your books on Amazon as well. So we'll definitely get a link up there as well. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our hour on romance novels. Thank you so much to Karen Kay, Maggie Blackbird, and Malia Powell. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about personhood status for Rivers. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for this program provided by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, the collective spirit and unifying voice of 37 tribal colleges and universities. For over 30 years, AHEC has worked to ensure that tribal sovereignty is recognized and respected, and that tribal colleges and universities are included in this nation's higher education system. Information on a tribal college or university near you at aihec.org.
Waka moot suit nuk medicare and got to lit nudaran cardank to chali suit genum barnic peeling ornick. Downutje paknak kuvu awalik but bakluku my medicare dot gavami. Unak kuvu atohonaran. Unanasunarun king onunk to moot suit nuk tali to linik. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.